You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Here's a special rebroadcast of a previous episode. Along with the joys of a new baby, we know that also comes with its own new set of challenges.
I remember being extremely sleep deprived, and also I didn't know what to do. You're out of the hospital, they give you the baby, and here, take care of it, right? I remember being constantly worried.
I remember trying to bathe her and just being scared because she was so tiny and so slippery and just being exhausted. Exhausted. Because she wouldn't sleep by herself. She didn't want to be set down at all. So I just remember holding her all the time.
I kind of needed that person to be able to say, yes, you're doing it right, or that's okay, like, do it this way. Like, I guess that encouraging or that reassurance, but not having that person there, it kind of defeats your confidence a little.
Those are the voices of Zeynep Matic Erdogan, Karita Shelby, and Rachel McCool, moms we caught up with at the Champaign Public Library. Thanks to producer Christine Herman for that audio. Whether it is that confidence, encouragement, or even just practical help, today we're going to talk about several new programs in Illinois that are helping new moms and dads in their first weeks at home with a new child. If you're a parent, we'd love to hear from you. What kind of support do you wish you would have had during this time? We did get a Facebook comment from Cheryl who says, I wish I had more help after going through a C-section. It's hard to ask. I just wish people had offered. Let's start with a new pilot program that just launched in Freeport, Illinois. It's about 30 miles west of Rockford. It's called Illinois Family Connects. And among other things, it provides in-home visits for new parents and their babies. Let's go to someone. I want to bring in Julia Munreese now. She's actually the director of family services at Stevenson County Health Department, and she's been overseeing this Illinois Family Connects home visit program. Julia, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
I wonder if you could just tell me, what's the idea behind sending a nurse into the home of new parents in these first few weeks?
Well, I think it's to give a parent an opportunity to ask any question that they might have about their new baby. Even if you're a second or a third time mom, things change over time. And it's an opportunity to know what's best for my baby and what's best for my family and have the information so you can make those decisions.
And what makes these visits different from, say, a new mom or dad bringing their baby into the doctor?
Well, the difference is that the nurses who come to your home will be there for probably anywhere from an hour and a half to 2 hours on their first visit. So oftentimes when you go to the doctor's office, you'll go in and see the doctor and maybe see him for 10 or 15 minutes. And then on your way out to the car, you think to yourself, oh, I wish I would have asked about this, or I wish I would have asked about that. So in having a visit right there in your home for a two-hour window of time, it gives a parent time to think about things and be able to ask the questions that they would have in their normal daily routines.
Joining us now is Rachel Garman. She's a Freeport mother who just gave birth to her first baby in March and was Illinois Family Connect's very first client. Hey, Rachel, was that your experience as well with the program?
Yes, absolutely. My daughter had probably a month in between her doctor's visits, and this at-home program was amazing because I had a list of questions in between those visits that got answered.
Like, what kind of questions did you have?
Mostly, I was wondering if my daughter was gaining enough weight because I was having problems with breastfeeding. So at my home visit, I was able to have my daughter weighed, and she was measured as well, and I was able to see that she was gaining weight, so it was very reassuring for me.
Sure, yeah, that's always something that's lots of parents worry about in the beginning, right? And I wonder, what made you decide to participate, Rachel, in this Illinois Family Connects program?
Well, I am a new mother, and I'm 22 years old, so I'm young, and my mother at the time wasn't living in the area, so I knew that I had questions and I would need help, so I thought that this would be a perfect program for me.
Mm-hmm. And do you feel like it made a difference personally for you to participate in this program?
Absolutely. It made me so much more confident as a mother, as a new mom.
Yeah. And what I mean, and wonder, so, I mean, obviously, the breastfeeding probably is always something that takes a little bit of getting used to. Did you feel like having someone in your house who was there, that made it a little bit easier and maybe more intimate and kind of was that?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. And what other things do you think the nurse was able to help you with that maybe you didn't even think of beforehand?
Well, I was having trouble with getting my daughter to calm down at night. She was getting really fussy, and it was difficult for me to figure out what would help her. And my nurse was able to give me a few different tricks to help with that, like swaddling and pacifier and putting in her swing and different things like that.
And do you feel like, I wonder, Rachel, do you feel like those are questions that you were able to ask other people, other new moms, or did the information feel better because it was also coming from a medical professional?
It felt so much better coming from a medical professional just because so many of my peers and family members have different, they have different ideas of what is right to do with your baby. So it was nice to hear, a valid answer to my questions.
Yeah. And how do you think have you talked to other moms? How have they reacted when you talked about your experience with this program?
They were really interested in it. They thought it was really cool that I was able to do that. All the mothers that I'm friends with have older kids now, but they wish they would have had something like that when they were new moms.
Well, Rachel, thanks so much. I really appreciate you joining us. I know you took some time out of your busy morning to talk to us, so I appreciate you sharing your story with us. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you.
Julia, can I ask, as Rachel was sharing all of that, you know, obviously Rachel's talking about her age and being a new mom and her mom not being nearby. What do you think, what are the issues that the nurses are kind of on the lookout for when they're doing these home visits?
Well, as they're doing the home visits, there's some probably wider categories of things that they're, you know, being on the lookout for or have general information about, like safe sleep, managing an infant who's crying a lot, what your plans are for child care. I know, for example, in Rachel's case, she was returning back to work. And so, you know, we were able to say, do you have plans for childcare? Is that something you're comfortable with? And then if she did not have that information, we could tell her what's available, what kind of questions she could ask when looking for a childcare provider. So many different avenues of things to look at, including parent well-being, parent emotional support, safety in the community, as well as the infant's health.
That's Julia Monresis. She's the director of family services at Stevenson County Health Department. They're overseeing the new Illinois Family Connects home visit program that's in conjunction with FHN Memorial Hospital in Freeport. I want to bring someone else into this conversation as well. Karen O'Donnell is an associate professor in psychiatry and behavioral services. She's also assistant professor in pediatrics at Duke University. She developed the Durham Connects program, and that's after which this Illinois pilot program is being modeled. Hi, Karen. Thanks for joining us as well.
Hi.
So,
Hi.
Yeah,
Thank
Karen,
you.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Can you explain, by the way, what went into you deciding to develop this program in North Carolina?
Well, first of all, it was a team of people. I didn't do it alone. A couple of really wonderful collaborators. But in 2002, our major funder sought us out at Duke to help improve child well-being at a community level. There are many home visit models that are very good and show strong evidence for baby and family. But the funders were after a public health approach that would be available to everyone because everyone has needs with a newborn in the house. So from 2002, our team developed the program, piloted the program, and we are now at a point of disseminating the program to other states and counties. Illinois has been especially receptive. They're now in two areas, and I think the plan of the First Lady and ounce for prevention is to make it statewide. So hooray. I'm sure Rachel would agree.
I'm sure she would. Julia, how is this being funded, the Illinois Family Connects program?
It is backed by some federal and state funds, and we're working with the Governor's Office of Early Childhood Development and Illinois State Board of Education.
Julia, as you're listening to Karen talk about the ideas behind the program, I wonder from a health department perspective why you think it's important that you all are offering this.
Well, I think that, Karen hit it on the head. It is a public health model. And public health is always interested in looking at the total population. So, again, while there are home visiting programs that might look at risk populations, this is something that's offered to everyone.
Right. So there's no income level with this. This is offered to anyone who wants to sign up for this.
Correct. Anybody who's in our pilot project framework, yes, absolutely.
And how are you finding parents now, Julia? How have you reached out? Like, how did you find Rachel?
Well, we're finding parents very receptive, but we're also working with our partner, FHN Memorial Hospital, and we're going right to the hospital unit every day during the week to meet with new moms and offer the service.
Mm-hmm. So, Karen, when you were looking at this model, and I'm thinking in particular of what you did in North Carolina, and you're talking about this from a public health standpoint, is the idea to catch problems in early stages before they become emergencies? Is it more just to provide general support? It's kind of thinking about just preventative and wellness and healthcare from a public health perspective?
All of the above. Families have unique needs and also many of the same needs. It could be anything from needing to be hooked up to food stamps to figuring out where the highest quality child care is, as well as the nurses do a physical assessment of baby and mom for postpartum issues. So there are many things in common with each visit, but each mother's and family issues are addressed individually as well. So what you said was true. Both are true.
And Karen, how common is it, these programs? I know you launched this in North Carolina. Illinois is now about to start doing this. I feel like this is maybe a more common model in Europe. But is this a common thing to do in the U.S.?
It hasn't been, and we're hoping it will be. You're absolutely right. It's much more common in Europe. England, I guess, has the best paradigm for newborn home visits.
Right. I was going to say that's the one I'm most familiar with. Yeah, because I know the English
system. Germany has a great model. It extends well beyond ours. I wish we were able to do what they do.
What do they do in Germany? What do they do in Germany?
Well, I'm going to make this up. It's actually 6 months to a year of home visits.
Wow.
And
okay.
Baby weight, support for mom. So it's an extended involvement, as well as the mothers have paid time off from work for a longer period of time. New Zealand also has a program, and I'm sure there are other countries that do. And I think in the U.S., we're discovering both the benefits for families and a financial benefit for health systems when the needs are addressed in the home at 3 weeks. Our biggest supports are from hospitals and primary care pediatrics because they know they can't do everything in 10 minutes. And we are very closely linked with those providers because they use us and we use them, and the family gets what they need that way.
Karen, how much savings? You said there's a financial savings. What have you seen in North Carolina?
In our site in Durham, North Carolina, we did an evaluation just of the frequency of families using the emergency department or having emergency overnight visits in the hospital. It was greatly reduced in our first randomized controlled trial, and we figure each dollar spent saved $3 of medical care.
Wow.
Because
okay.
Families learn to call their doctor or, learn not to run to the emergency room. There are many other benefits that have been demonstrated, but that's the financial one that health systems want to hear about.
A very clear one. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation. We're talking about some new pilot programs launching in Illinois. Stay tuned to this encore edition of The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo.
the 21st is made possible in part by Krannert Art Museum at the University of Illinois, presenting the School of Art and Design Faculty Exhibition, on view through September 23rd. More information is available at kam.illinois.edu.
This is an encore edition of The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Right now, we're talking about Illinois Family Connects. It's a pilot program that's just launched in the Rockford area, in Freeport, actually. And we're talking about, it's based on a model that was started in North Carolina. My guests are Julia Monreese. She's the Director of Family Services at Stevenson County Health Department. She's been overseeing the Illinois Family Connects program we were talking about. Karen O'Donnell's also on the line with us from North Carolina. She helped develop the Durham Connects Integrated Home Visit Program that this one is based on. These are new government-funded programs. And, you know, Julia, we were just hearing Karen talk about sort of this model, how it's sort of maybe something that's being used more in other countries, now being used here. And I wanted to ask you, how is this system being integrated? How is a nurse home visit to a new mom tying in with sort of the standard well baby checkups, postpartum visits for the mother? How does it all come together?
Well, our initial visit is scheduled about 3 weeks out from after they leave the hospital. So that gives a mom time to get home. And many times when they first come home, they've got extra support in the home helping them. Maybe a grandmother or a husband might be home for a few days off of work and just have extra assistance. So we find that about 3 weeks is about the time where people start to get back to normal routines, and the mom might find herself at home alone with the baby and discover that she might have more questions than she realized that she had before. So it seems like it's a nice time to stop in the home. We also do offer, if they're having problems with breastfeeding when they leave the hospital, that they can call if they have problems and need us to come sooner.
And also, I'm thinking about 3 weeks in and thinking about the fact that I think the numbers are 1 in 7 women have postpartum depression. Is that something that normally manifests itself right away, or is it something that also maybe takes around that 3 week, 1 month mark?
Well, I think that, you know, immediately after birth, we recognize that there is that emotional letdown that we always or sometimes call baby blues. And so there is a very distinct difference between what's considered baby blues and postpartum depression. And so, yes, coming at that 3 week mark gives you a better time to look at the mom and get a better gauge and make sure that it's not just the emotions of just having the baby that are the baby blues, and that it might be something more serious when we do the screen.
And Karen, what other kinds of things are in this program nurses designed to look out for? Not just, you know, we've been talking about breastfeeding or depression, but there are lots of practical, I think, maybe, I wonder, other advice offered for moms to help bond with their children, reading, or safe sleep practices. What kind of thing, mm-hmm. other things are nurses equipped to talk about?
Well, first of all, it's a good thing it's nurses. Mothers really welcome that health professional into their home. But the protocol, it's a standardized protocol, and the nurses touch base with everything on the agenda, which I can talk about in a minute. But the important thing is they do it in a family-friendly way. So the question might be, how are things going? But that the answers may address health care, emotional well-being, the kind of support the mother's getting, and that kind of thing. So although it's an informal and family-friendly visit, there are topics that are routinely touched upon that include health care, health needs, child care, sleep, crying, material needs. Does the family have what they need to thrive? And then emotional support. Are there risk factors in the home like substance abuse? But also, who's helping this mom take care of this baby? And while she's taking care of the baby, who's taking care of her? So we think of it in terms of several factors that seem most universal for moms and dads and grandmothers and babies at that three-week mark.
Julia, as Karen's been talking about, this was a program that's eligible. It's eligible for anyone can do this. It's not just targeting at-risk families. I wonder, what difference does it make for Stevenson County in particular to be able to launch this program?
Well, it's something that as a community, I think we were ready for. We have a long history of collaboration and working well together and support across social service agencies, the health networks, and the health department. So it just seemed like the right time to be able to step into this role and extend what we're offering and what we can do to support all the families in our community.
What advice do you have for other public health departments around the state who might be thinking about this?
I think that it is something very wonderful to look at, and it probably goes back to the days when in the 50s and 60s when a county nurse might come to your home to offer giving your child immunizations and check on you and see how things are going. So it's almost as if we're going back to what we had known before. I do think it's a wonderful thing to be able to offer, and it has its benefits that we can see throughout the community.
That's Julia Monresis. She's the Director of Family Services at Stevenson County Health Department and overseeing this Illinois Family Connects program in conjunction with FHN Memorial Hospital. Julia, thanks for being with me.
Thank you so much.
Karen, I want to thank you as well. And it's Karen O'Donnell, an associate professor in psychiatry and behavioral services. She's also an assistant professor in pediatrics at Duke University, where she helped develop this Durham Connects program. Thanks for being with us as well, Karen.
Oh, you're very welcome.
You know, as we've been talking about the challenges that new parents face and how hospitals and medical providers are trying to help, we wanted to go now to Champaign-Urbana and a new organization that's about providing all that other day-to-day support for parents. It's called Sistering CU, and I'm joined now by the group's co-founders, Erin Murphy and Dory Geisler. Erin, Dory, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
Erin, you know, as you were just listening to this pilot program that you were hearing about, sending nurses into homes to visit, can you tell us a little bit about your organization? Because you're sending trained volunteers to help with maybe more practical aspects of adjusting to motherhood. What kind of things are you guys doing?
Right. We're sending people who have volunteered in our community to go to the homes of families who've just had a baby to just help out with a basic menu of things such as, you know, doing light dishes, playing with the older children, holding the baby so the mom can take a shower or take a nap. You know, whatever she needs to do to feel human again, and give her a little bit of sanity.
Yeah, Dory. Yeah, why did you guys create this organization? Where did this come from?
Well, this came from kind of both our postpartum experiences. You know, I went into this is kind of based off my oldest child, who's just about to turn 14. So 14 years ago, you know, I feel like a lot of mothers, I probably got a lot of education, if you will, about the birth experience, but very little about what to expect postpartum. And I think I kind of naively went into it thinking I was just going to pop this baby out and put him in a sling and go about life as usual.
Yeah.
But
how did that turn out?
Yeah, not very well. right. And, you know, it soon became apparent that I was completely unprepared. You know, I had a very complicated labor. I actually had a postpartum hemorrhage. I fell in the hospital. I hit my head. I got a concussion. So physically, you know, I was not in a good place. Combine that with sleep deprivation, you know, isolation, and really kind of struggling with this transition to motherhood, the kind of identity crisis that goes with from being an independent person, kind of in control, to being responsible for a baby who's totally dependent on you. So, you know, I didn't go very well. I ended up with undiagnosed postpartum depression. And really wanted to start something like this to kind of help mothers deal with that transition time and really promote like education about what to expect, so you don't go into it thinking that, you know, life is just going to keep going with this little infant alongside of you.
That's Dori Geisler. She's the co-founder of Sistering CU. We're talking to her and Aaron Murphy about this organization, this volunteer organization they've founded. You know, we were talking to moms. We've been talking to moms all week, and I wanted to play another piece from Rachel McCool of Urbana saying she didn't where she was at when she had a baby. Let's hear what Rachel had to say.
We had offers from friends to like come over and help us, and I don't think we took advantage of it because I didn't want people to come over just to take out the trash. You know, I wasn't up for visiting them. I wouldn't want people to come over just to do my dishes.
Aaron, is that a common sentiment you think that moms in particular have, where people are offering help but then they just don't really, it's a really kind of, there gets to be a little disconnect between like, I want to help but I don't know how to ask for help?
I think it's twofold. I think mothers are, and women in general, we have this expectation that we're the caretakers. We're responsible for taking care of things. And to have somebody come take care of us is an awkward position to be in. We're not used to taking help. So there is that. If you do get help, you're offered help. I was offered a lot of help in my postpartum experience, but it is uncomfortable to have somebody come to your home and do your dishes or take out your trash. But so we want to change that expectation for moms that it's okay to take help and to ask for help. But then also there's other people who are, you know, maybe don't have that safety net or a support network to even have somebody offer it in the first place. So we want to be there for the people who don't, who maybe are transient, you know, moving from all over with the university in our town, or just don't have that safety net, to be able to ask for help from us. And if you are offered help, you know, we want to make moms feel comfortable to take it.
Yeah. Dori, how do you guys do that?
How do we do that? Well, what we do is we begin by training our volunteers. And one of the things actually we do in our training is teaching them to kind of think about what it's like to be in a position to ask for help. And our volunteers do two training sessions. And then when they get matched with a family, so families and volunteers can both apply for the program to volunteer or get assistance via our website at sisteringcu.org. And then we will match a volunteer with a family that has similar needs. So it depends on whether or not the family wants care of the other children in the home, or if they really just want companionship or household duties, and whatever the volunteer is most interested in providing, we try and match them with a volunteer.
And what kind of training do you do for the volunteers?
We train them in just kind of really thinking about how to nurture mothers. That's one of the reasons that we're here. And so, you know, our culture really kind of has a baby first afterbirth approach, and we're trying to flip that and kind of look more at nurturing the mothers. And so some of the families that we've been serving thus far, you know, they really want companionship. We also train our volunteers on what to expect about infant crying, SIDS recommendations, general baby care, sibling care, and also screening for postpartum depression.
You know, as you mentioned sort of changing culture, I wanted to play another piece of audio from Zeynep Matic Erdogan, a Champaign resident. She was talking about the differences she saw in support for new parents in the U.S. versus her home country.
I'm from Turkey, and there, you know, it's kind of the norm that, you know, grandparents help with the baby as long as they can. Luckily, I had my parents with me at the time, and I appreciated a lot because it was obvious that we needed that extra help.
Again, that's Zeynep Matic Erdogan, Champaign resident, sharing how little bit of a cultural difference is. And Aaron, I wonder how much, you know, you think as you have looked at the way other cultures sort of handle this and the helping part of it and expectations of moms, where do you think we're at in the U.S. and here in Illinois? Where would you like to see us?
I think the U.S. is unfortunately at the bottom of helping take care of moms, and I think the rise in the maternal mortality rate is kind of an indicator of that. But I would say within the United States, Illinois has been at the forefront of trying to address some of these issues. Like, for example, screening. It was the first state to mandate a screening for postpartum depression at the 6-week checkup. And like the pilot program you were just talking about, seems there's a lot of support in Illinois for that kind of thing. So fortunately, we live in Illinois, and people are supportive of trying to get more care for mothers. But absolutely more needs to be done.
I wonder, Dori, what do you want others who aren't new parents to know about this? What can people who are listening who maybe haven't had a baby or want to help out, how should they be looking at this?
That's a good question that I probably haven't thought about. I guess really what one of our missions is to kind of teach the culture, provide community education, and kind of foster a culture of postpartum care. So, you know, our country doesn't really have a recognized postpartum care period. You know, you see headlines like get your pre-baby body back, you know, in 3 months, that type of thing. And what we're really trying to, you know, really get information out there and say, you know, this is a transition period and it's a period where moms need care. And, you know, just because other people have gone before us and done it without help doesn't mean it has to be that way, that it could be easier with some help.
Yeah. Erin, any other final advice you want to add?
We're just wanting to be there as that extra pair of hands, the listening ears for families. And if we could get more champions on board for postpartum care, like grandmothers, grandfathers, friends and family, and help moms become more comfortable with taking that help, I think we would see a real shift and maybe a reduced rate of postpartum depression that comes from isolation and just those extra stressors.
That said, you guys are still, I imagine, looking for more volunteers to sign up to help with Sistering CU?
Absolutely.
Absolutely. I don't imagine there'll ever be a shortage of families, but we can't serve families without the volunteers.
Exactly.
They need to come first.
So I want to thank Dori Geisler and Erin Murphy, both of them co-founders of Sistering CU. Erin, Dori, thanks so much for being with me.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you so much for having us, Nyla.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
This is an encore edition of The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. When Simon Tam founded The Slants 11 years ago in Portland, Oregon, he wanted to make sure that younger Asian Americans could see themselves represented in the rock music scene. Their music's been compared to 80s rock groups like The Cure and Duran Duran, as well as more modern artists like The Killer. They call their sound Chinatown Dance Rock. And the band name, The Slants, was also part of a long legal battle that found its way to the Supreme Court. Earlier this year, government attorneys argued their name shouldn't be trademarked because it was offensive. The Supreme Court unanimously sided with their case, and The Slants now have the right to trademark their name. Simon Tan is the founder and bassist of The Slants, and he's on the line with us now from Portland. Hey, Simon, welcome back to The 21st. Thanks for being here.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
So this legal battle's been going on for nearly a decade. I wonder, what was the first thing you did when you found out that you guys had won the case?
I checked Twitter.
to make sure honestly, it was really true.
Well, I found out through Twitter. I woke up, it was early in the morning. I had just been working all weekend long. So I was kind of groggy and forgot that it was a possible Supreme Court decision day. And my phone was going crazy. So when I checked it, I was like, oh, I missed 700 messages and calls. Something must have happened. So I hopped on Twitter, and the first thing I saw was public radio with a tweet saying that the Supreme Court ruled in our favor. So I immediately went to my email box to look for something from my attorney, because that really can mean any number of things. I didn't really quite understand what the ruling was, what the opinion was. So I opened it. You know, he had an email that said, congratulations, and it had the decision attached. And that was the depth of the analysis I had. So I started reading it, and, you know, maybe on page 4 or 5, the calls kind of began, and I was just kind of on this media roller coaster for the next 10 or 12 hours. So really, I didn't even have a chance to process, to respond, to think about how things would, you know, how I was even feeling. Like, I didn't eat. I was just in one call after another.
And so let's rewind back. And for people who are not familiar, can you share where the name The Slants came from and why that was so important for you to have this for the name of the band?
Sure. Well, for me, the name came, the band, the whole idea of the group came from wanting to provide a bold betrayal of Asian American culture, wanting to provide representation. So the band existed as an idea before the band name even came about. When I started thinking about band names as a possibility, I started asking my friends. I said, what's something you think all Asians have in common? And they would immediately say, slanted eyes, which I always thought was interesting, because I was like, this is not true. Like, not all Asians have slanted eyes. We're not the only people who have any kind of slant to our eyes. But as I started thinking more deeply about it, I thought, you know, we could really talk about our perspective, our slant on life of what it's like to be people of color while paying homage to Asian American activists who'd been using slant in this reappropriated manner for about 30 or 40 years now. So it was just a great way to kind of use our art as a platform to drive this activist approach of trying to bring more nuance into these ideas and conversations about false stereotypes that people hold about us.
And it's kind of wild, because when did you find out that you couldn't trademark this name because it was offensive?
That was early 2010. So we'd already been touring and playing in this band for 3 years, playing at Asian American cultural festivals throughout the country, rock clubs. We had a couple of releases under our belt already. And so it was quite a shock to me that the trademark office said our name was disparaging to persons of Asian descent. But not only that it could possibly be disparaging, but that they said it was highly disparaging to a substantial composite of Asians. And I remember thinking, we've been working with our communities for years now. Who did they find who's actually offended by it? But they couldn't cite a single Asian American who had issues with our name. So they instead quoted UrbanDictionary.com, which is, of course, a joke wiki website. And it was just kind of outrageous that the federal government was using its full power to deny us rights based on a joke website.
Well, and also, you're Asian, like I'm Asian, right? Because I think this is part of the conversation about names and stereotypes and derogatory things, is that there is sort of, I imagine for you, like, you feel like there's also a lot of not just this is a First Amendment issue, but there's also, I think, I would imagine for you, part of reclaiming sort of your identity. And I imagine that's a lot that's also behind this name.
Absolutely. And that was kind of a big part of the principles on which we fought for, that as people of color, we've never had agency over our own identities. We've always had stereotypes used against us. So for us to shift that power dynamic and say, you know what, we're going to claim this, we're going to own it and can reappropriate it, that was a pretty significant shift. And but to have that stripped away because of one random examining attorney at the trademark office to take that away from us was kind of devastating from an emotional kind of perspective.
Simon, there's also, I think, a little bit of an irony in this that I wonder if you see this, that that this case is around Asian Americans, an Asian American term that's offensive, because I feel like a lot of times in the Asian American community, there's even just a whole conversation about, is there even racism against Asian Americans? I wonder if that's also for you, you find it a little ironic that this whole case also hinged on something that was Asian.
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly, I think what this case really helps illustrate is that our group is extremely diverse. We're not a monolithic group. I mean, the Asians are one of the few kind of racial categories just bound by geography, and it at some points included some countries and other points did not. So it's not surprising that we have diverse opinions about where Asian American rights are. But I think this case, you know, I've been really humbled that it's a part of this larger conversation to put it in the forefront once again. I mean, there's only been about half a dozen cases before the Supreme Court that really dealt with Asian American issues. And so this kind of reiterated the fact that, hey, we're not quite as post-racial as we thought, and our communities are disparately impacted by some laws in ways that we didn't imagine before.
And that is a whole interesting thing that you and I are in the same racial category in this country, right? My family is Indian by way of the Caribbean, but I'm Asian American, as are you, who is a Chinese American from San Diego. I wonder for you, this case, sort of this kind of the agency that you feel like you have been talking about, how much you think this sort of represents kind of thinking about Asian Americans and Asian American activism in this country and people sort of rallying behind identity. Do you feel like we're in a different place right now with that?
I think our community is still kind of mobilizing. We're still figuring out how to use power and also to try and get beyond these little boxes we've put ourselves in. And traditionally, the whole idea of being Asian American is a fairly new one. Prior to that, we were just Chinese, we were just Koreans, or whatever kind of countries we're descended from. But the Asian American movement really kind of became this rallying cry a couple decades ago to say, you know what, we're much better, we're much more powerful if we're unified, if we can have this bigger base to work from to try and shift power. So I think we're still trying to figure out what that means, especially because we know that Asian Americans are quite diverse in our approaches. Some are far, far left, some are far, far right. And so how do we use this kind of shared identity, at least in a loose sense, in a way that can articulate values that represent all of us?
And is it a strange place for you as a musician? Did you think that you would find yourself in the middle of all of this activism? Because ultimately, you know, this is about your band, right?
Yeah, we are a band. We're not just a, you know, set of law junkies or anything like that. But I don't think anyone could have imagined all this to happen. You know, when I started the band, it was simply about representation. It was because this was in 2004 when I had the band idea name, pre-YouTube even. And when I was like, I couldn't think of a single Asian American artist who had been on the cover of Rolling Stone or Spin. I couldn't think of any Asian American artist highlighted by MTV or Billboard. And I wanted to change that. I thought, you know, there's 17 million Asian Americans. At least back then there were. Now we have more. But I was like, how many Asian American artists could I even think of? And at the time, I couldn't think of any. I was like, well, there's that dude in Smashing Pumpkins, and that's kind of about all I had. So for that to kind of shift into what we're doing now is something I couldn't quite imagine at the time. I only got hints of it a few months after we started, because I started getting letters from Asian American youth saying, like, thank you for existing. Thank you for showing me it's possible to be in a rock band. And then I just knew at that point, like, if we're going to be advancing our this band, whether we like it or not, we're going to be judged by our race and that we're going to be seen as representatives of it. And so we better really be on point. We better know our stuff when it comes to racism and, you know, things affecting equity, diversity, inclusion. And that's how we kind of got started in that work. We started leading workshops and oftentimes doing anti-racism seminars on behalf of the U.S. government, ironically.
Yeah. So I wonder, what have you been hearing from fans of the band throughout the case? And also, I'm thinking other, like you're saying, your young Asian American fans.
I think a lot of people are really excited. They know how long we've been fighting for this case. So our fans, people who've been there since the beginning, who've kind of watched this case evolve, are really excited to see that we finally have been vindicated and to some degree. So they're definitely excited. And kind of people who are a little bit newer, who don't really understand all the nuances of, say, this 70-year-old bit of trademark law that's actually fairly obscure, are still trying to understand what it all means. But I think as a whole, most people have expressed a lot of appreciation for the advancement of the First Amendment.
Yeah. Just last question for you. We wanted to play a song of yours here. It's actually called From the Heart. This is your open letter you wrote to the trademark office, right?
That's correct. Yeah.
And has this case inspired any more music for you? Are you going to keep writing? I wonder, is there going to be a Supreme Court version of this soon?
You know, I'm not sure, because it was a challenge to write about this in a kind of personal way for a while. I kept telling my band that it would be a great idea, but I said, you know, writing about obscure trademark laws doesn't make good art. That sounds like a
That's not going to get you on the cover of Rolling Stone, you don't think?
Yeah. Well, I just thought it was just so corny. I was like, this is not good. But my guitar player, like, sat with it and wanted to talk about this larger idea. Like, sure, it's an open letter to the trademark office, but it's also addressed to people who have doubts about kind of what we do, people who have doubts about, you know, reappropriation, and it wanted to be this kind of sincere message to them, saying like, yeah, you know, we're sorry that if you take offense by what we do, we're sorry that if you don't kind of quite understand what we're trying to do, even though it does benefit everybody. And so we're trying to explain, there's like a line in there that says the language of oppression will lose to education. And it's kind of like, yes, you know, we need to move beyond treating racial slurs as the end-all be-all of racism and move towards those institutionalized forms of discrimination that are prevalent in our culture.
On that note, let's end with From the Heart. I want to thank Simon Tam, founder and bassist of The Slants, talking to us about the Supreme Court case. The Supreme Court unanimously sided with The Slants. Hey, Simon, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
Sorry if my notes too sharp. Sorry if our voice too raw. Don't make the pen a weapon and censor our intelligence until it costs me nothing at all. Sorry if you take offense. We made up rules and played pretend. We know you fear change. It's something so strange, but nothing's gonna get in our way. There's no room for your backwards feelings and backyard dealings. We're never gonna settle, never gonna settle. No, we won't remain silent. No, it's our defining moment. We sing from the heart. We sing from the heart.
That does it for us today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. If you have Alexa, we're easy to find. Tell her, ask NPR One to play The 21st. All of those links, directions for Alexa, every other way to contact us. If you want to leave us a voicemail, if you'd like to send us an email, if you want to follow us on social media, all of that information is at our website, 21stshow.org. I'm Nyla Boodoo, broadcasting today from the Medill School of Journalism in downtown Chicago. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.
Systems all wrong, and it won't be long before the kids are singing our song.